watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This weekend, I went to my neighbor's birthday party. It was a beautiful spring evening. Trees newly leafed out. Huge old lilacs in full bloom. A long table was set outside in the garden, laden with a variety of foods brought by the guests and offered by the hosts. Four flavors of ice cream, chocolate, vanilla, black raspberry, and butter pecan, blueberry pie, peanut butter cookies and brownies, tortilla chips, salsa and spice cake, curried salad, and pizza. There were people of every age, and a couple of dogs. One of the other neighbor's teenage son built a big bonfire in the field. It flared up as the sun went down. Two guys brought out guitars and sang, and the guests sang along. I describe this to you not because it was an unusual sort of party, but just the opposite. Such parties are enjoyed by people everywhere. The scenery may differ, or the food, or the songs, and the language they're sung in. But the essence is the same, a celebration of the bonds of affection and community. Imagine, then, that out of the pink-streaked sky roar two fighter jets with guns blazing, that a few seconds later leave in their wake bullet-ridden bodies, bloody and red on the green spring grass, and the bloodless faces of the survivors who scream, "No, no, no," endlessly beside the lifeless forms of their loved ones. Halfway around the world somewhere, an impeccably coiffed TV news anchor reports. The Air Force launched a raid on a gathering in a northern province yesterday, killing 25, including two children aged 4 and 6 years. International human rights groups have denounced this attack on what they claim was a birthday party. Central Command spokesman Colonel Turdbag said intelligence reported insurgents in the area, located near one of the planet's largest reserves of fresh water. He said, "The military is investigating." Meanwhile, four of our troops were killed in Rochester today when an improvised bomb planted by insurgents toppled the bridge over the Genesee River. This brings our death toll in the war to 3,012. Anti-war lawmakers today said too many of our troops have died and introduced a bill for withdrawal. But it was struck down by fellow lawmakers and the president, who said the war will continue until we have prevailed in our objectives. That there will be no troop withdrawal until the New Yorkers have met benchmarks, such as passing a new water law that allows foreign corporations unlimited access to remove water. Such a scenario seems unlikely in New York State, but it's happening right now in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and has happened in dozens of countries before that. The fighter jets are made by American corporations, paid for by American taxpayers, with money appropriated by the American Congress, flown by members of the American military, who, after completing their murderous mission, hightail it back to their base to drink $100 Coca-Colas supplied by Halliburton and to write graffiti on 5,000-year-old buildings, destroying humanity's priceless cultural heritage, oblivious to its meaning and history. How does a society come to be ruled over by a gang of thugs, con men, and torturers? Why have its people not dragged them from their marble halls? Instead, they allow them to repeatedly pick their pockets and take their children for an endless project of murder for profit? How is it stripped of its moral imagination? How is it made to focus its attentions and energy on trivia? In the wake of the U.S. Congress failure once again to stop funding the project of blood for profit, we will examine these questions.
In the following recording by the L.A. Sound Posse, Dr. John Marciano continues his public seminar series with Empire as a Way of Life, a monthly lecture and discussion presented until June of 2007. Dr. Marciano says about Empire as a Way of Life, "A fundamental purpose of our meetings is to understand the systemic nature of the U.S. empire and the economic and military imperialism that is its lifeblood." The historian William Appleman Williams argues that empire became a way of life in the U.S., a combination of patterns of thought and action that, as it becomes habitual and institutionalized, defines the thrust and character of a culture and society. This way of life has convinced many U.S. Americans they have a right or manifest destiny to impose their political and economic policies upon others. The lectures are given at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Dr. John Marciano is Professor Emeritus, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race.
So, to begin, Michael Parenti asserts that imperialism has been the most powerful force in world history for the past 500 years. The first victims of Western European imperialism, he argues, were other Europeans, for example, the Irish, and Eastern Europeans, whom we now call Slavs. Parenti tells us that so frequently and prolonged was the enslavement of Eastern Europeans that Slav became synonymous with servitude. Over the past 500 years, however, European and U.S. imperialism have primarily exploited the Third World, a source of raw material and slaves, and a market for manufactured goods. This market now includes capital in the form of machinery, technology, investments, and loans. The new imperialism differs from earlier empires in the way it systematically accumulates capital through the organized exploitation of labor and the penetration of overseas markets. The key to modern imperialism is capitalist expansion. Parenti challenges the prevailing view of imperialism and third world poverty, often called underdevelopment, arguing that it is often looked at as an original historic condition. This is not the case, he argues, as the Third World has long produced great treasures and other natural resources. The truth is that the Third World is actually rich. Only its people are poor, and it is because of the pillage they have endured. This analysis is similar to others we have cited in this course and discussed, Samir Amin, Eduardo Galeano, and Felix Green, among others. The rape of the Third World has been justified by self-serving imperialist theories. For example, people in tropical lands are slothful and do not work as hard as those in the temperate zone. This is not true, Parenti argues, as people of warm climates built magnificent civilizations well before Europe emerged from the Dark Ages. And today they often work long, hard hours for meager sums. He challenges Eurocentric theories by citing Europe's social ills during the height of its colonial domination, pointing out that Europe was ahead in such things as social inequality and poverty, mistreatment of women and children, and frequency of famine, slavery, prostitution, piracy, religious massacre, and inquisitional torture. Other than those things, it was a peachy keen place to live in. The ultimate basis of European domination, according to Parenti, has really rested on its advantage in navigation and armaments. Muskets and cannons, Gatling guns and gunboats, and today missiles, helicopter gunships, and fighter bombers have been the deciding factor when West meets East and North meets South. His critique of underdevelopment asks us to see it as a result of social relations that have been forcefully imposed on countries. With the advent of Western colonizers, the people of the Third World were actually set back in their development. British imperialism in India provides an instructive example. Parenti points to a truth hidden by our schooling and mass media indoctrination. The Third World is not underdeveloped. but overexploited. Imperialism has created maldevelopment because wealth is transferred from third world peoples to U.S. economic elites by direct plunder, the expropriation of natural resources, and other forms of exploitation. Parenti details the third world imperialism that has resulted in oppression. Nations have concentrated on exporting a few raw materials or labor-intensive commodities, and poor nations find themselves in acute competition with other impoverished nations. Attempts by third world countries to overcome their vulnerability by forming trade cartels are usually unsuccessful. This imperialist inequality has also been deepened because in many poor countries, over half the manufacturing assets are owned or controlled by foreign companies. Compounding this inequality is that large portions of the earnings of indebted nations go to servicing their debt. U.S. and European imperialism have also, he argues, been backed by unspeakable repression and state terror. Thus, there have been few, if any, peaceable colonizations. I would maintain there has never been a single peaceable colonial venture anywhere in the world. I'm going a little further than Parenti is. Imperialism, therefore, he argues, is not a natural historical phenomenon because it must rely repeatedly upon armed coercion and repression. Empires do not emerge in a fit of absent-mindedness, as was once said of the British Empire. They are built upon the sword, the whip, and the gun. This truth has almost never been examined in our schools and mass media. Therefore, most citizens here don't have a clue about what the U.S. has actually done to the third world, to those, of course, that we just want to help. Remember, as we've discussed in our course, the U.S. always goes abroad to do good throughout the world. This terror is not some arbitrary or irrational process, but is used to further a larger process of extermination and repression in defense of class interests. It is an eminently rational undertaking to safeguard private overseas interests. It is not mindless or stupid, but quite reasonable, given the fundamental nature of the U.S. capitalist system. Parenti bluntly answers a question that has troubled some U.S. citizens for generations. Why has a professedly peace-loving democratic nation found it necessary to use so much violence and repression against so many people in so many places? And, of course, over so much time. He argues it's because the ultimate goal of U.S. policy is a quest to make the world safe for the Fortune 500 and its global system of capital accumulation. Those who move towards some kind of economic independence or any sort of populist redistributive politics will face U.S. intervention or invasion. I would argue the evidence for this assertion is overwhelming. In order to get citizens to support such imperialist aggression, U.S. ruling elites must convince the rest of us that we share a common interest with the giant multinationals. But on almost every issue, Parenti claims, the people are not in the same boat with the big companies. I would say every issue, not on almost every issue. Despite this fact, many here have been convinced that there is a common interest in what is one of the greatest triumphs of class-based propaganda in history. Parenti disagrees with what he argues is the popular imperialism view of William Appleman, Williams and Empire as a Way of Life, which is one of the books we've examined, asserting that historically, ordinary Americans usually have opposed intervention or given only lukewarm support. Parenti believes the American people are not the prime motivating force of the war policy. They do not sweep their leaders into war on a tide of popular hysteria. It is the other way around. Their leaders take them for a ride and bring out the worst in them. Although I question this interpretation of Williams, this is an important point. Against their objective interests, brainwashed citizens end up supporting imperialism as a result of propaganda organized and disseminated by the CIA, mass media, U.S. government-funded agencies, and the AFL-CIO. In his discussion of empire and democracy, Parenti sounds a great deal like Chalmers Johnson. Strong empire must bring about a weak democracy. Actually, in his latest book, Nemesis, which I just finished, in which I think is the best of Johnson's trilogy by far, Johnson argues empire is destroying democracy. And linked to this destruction is the economic ruin and bankruptcy facing the country from its imperialism abroad. According to Parenti, between 1948 and 1994, the federal government spent almost $11 trillion on the military. That is more than the cumulative monetary value of all human-made wealth in the United States. I mean, if that figure dazzles you, the figure is actually much greater, right? His figures go up to 1994. According to the Center for Defense Information, which is a great group in Washington, often former military people, total military spending from 1946 through 2008, this last year is an estimate, is some $21.6 trillion. The CDI figure covers just official Pentagon spending. It does not include the black box funds for the CIA, our friends at the NSA. They need a lot of equipment to listen to us. Interest on the debt related to past wars, funds for veterans' benefits, all of which would add a few more trillions to the total. I did some calculations. The 21.6 trillion figure comes to $72,000 per capita at the present 300 million people in the United States. That's $2.5 trillion for the state of California, $288 billion just for Los Angeles, and $6.2 billion for little old Santa Monica. Now, you imagine what this city could do with $6.2 billion. Parenti is right, therefore, to ascribe most of our domestic woes to military spending. As he states, the cost of building one aircraft carrier could feed several million of the poorest, hungriest children in America for 10 years. The huge amounts spent on the military mean that Americans must endure the neglect of environmental needs, decay of our cities, and deterioration of our transportation, education, and healthcare systems. Another aspect of empire, and this is also a theme in Chalmers Johnson's latest book, is that it concentrates power in the hands of the few and robs the populace of effective self-rule. The empirical historical data that prove this assertion are overwhelming, especially when it comes to the growth of the imperial presidency since the end of World War II. The U.S. imperialist state has been involved in hundreds of overt and covert acts of aggression around the world in the last 60 years, since the end of World War II. Not one has been declared by Congress as mandated by the Constitution. There has not been a declaration of war since December 8, 1941. Resolutions don't count. Parenti's conclusion in this first section of his book may depress readers. He argues U.S. imperialism has been remarkably successful in undermining popular revolutions and buttressing conservative capitalist regimes in every region of the world. Thus, U.S. imperialism is not stupid and mistake-prone, but actually remarkably successful and brutal in the service of elite economic interests. An analysis of the historical record reveals that the U.S. ruling class has never consciously pursued a policy that put lofty ideals and common people's interests ahead of greed and power. Not once, not ever. A number of scholars have provided supporting evidence for Parenti's assertions on imperialism. In his work, Imperial Delusions, the political theorist Karl Boggs argues that the U.S. has evolved into something of an outlaw rogue state, the kind of fearsome entity conjured up by its own incessant propaganda. This rogue state status, however, has been obscured by Orwellian language, as officials and media pundits apply the term defense to the massive and clearly strategic U.S. global presence. We continually read about the Defense Department, the defense budget, rather than the War Department, which was the accurate name that was changed by the 1947 National Security Act. I'd actually like to go back. I'm a conservative on that issue. Boggs claims that U.S. actions throughout the world have nothing to do with defense and everything to do with terror. Since the U.S. has a long history of warfare against foreign countries it would be impossible to arrive at a definition of terrorism that excludes its behavior. What little critical understanding of the U.S. system of military terror we have, in his view, owes a great deal to the work on the Pentagon system by the sociologist C. Wright Mills, especially in his classic book, The Power Elite, which came out in 1956. It's really a must-read if you want to understand Pentagon militarism. This book anticipated the dangers of U.S. militarism as it stood virtually alone in its uncompromising critique of the U.S. war economy that enabled citizens to gain a real understanding of how U.S. foreign policy is shaped. What Mills saw in the 1950s was a military-industrial complex that few others were able to see, then or later. Many of us recall Eisenhower's statement in his farewell address about the dangers of the military-industrial complex. But few are aware of C. Wright Mills' far more powerful critique of the Pentagon. It was Mills who first foresaw how the war economy, the Pentagon bureaucracy, and an aggressive foreign policy converged within the same matrix of development and logic. Since World War II, according to Boggs, the United States military has provided an international shield for Western corporations and financial institutions, more global than ever. Despite the propaganda about free enterprise, it's been military Keynesianism that has furnished a major stimulus for dominant economic growth on a foundation of scientific and technical innovations wedded to enormous corporate profits. As Noam Chomsky observes, it is difficult to imagine a system better designed for the benefit of the privileged few than the military system. A fundamental fact of U.S. history, according to Boggs, that the most established, most powerful liberal democracy in the world also has the longest and most brutal record of militarism among all nations, has been hidden by public and intellectual failure to confront the actualities of U.S. military power and the empire it supports. Despite myths to the contrary, the actual history is one of conquest and domination. Let me go back to Zinn, first chapter with Columbus. Genocidal wars against Indian tribes, the theft of land from Mexico and Spain, and the invasion of Russia after World War I, followed by a succession of bloody military interventions in Korea, Central America, the Caribbean, Persian Gulf, the Balkans, not to mention countless proxy wars, covert acts, and other interventions waged in scores of nations. One can only avoid this factual history by psychological denial and/or outright lying, produced by a compliant educational system and mass media that disarm the public from any substantive understanding and critique of this reality. Boggs asserts that U.S. nationalism has always been ethnocentric, messianic, and arrogant, tied as it has been to an ethos of expansion and conquest. Beneath the high-sounding ideals has been the mundane actuality of a ruthless, manipulative system that, when practiced by other nations, has been scornfully attacked. The dark side of U.S. foreign and military policy, he argues, is not a function of mistakes and miscalculations, but has been integral to the development process itself. The combination of the ethos of conquest, domination, and violence has allowed the U.S. to evolve into an outlaw country, the rogue state of all rogue states, intent on transforming the process of globalization into the building blocks of empire and military domination. Some harsh and tough assertion by Boggs. I would argue they are all true. Iqbal Ahmad, the late Iqbal Ahmad, was one of the world's foremost scholars on imperialism. In a series of essays, he laid out a brilliant critique of U.S. terror in the Third World. In one of them, The Lessons of Vietnam, he wrote about the incredible, perceptible gap between our, and here he was speaking about the Third World and his own native land of Pakistan, our need for social transformation and America's insistence on stability, between our impatience for change and America's obsession with order. Our move toward revolution and America's belief in the plausibility of achieving reforms under the robber barons of the world. Our longing for absolute national sovereignty and America's preference for pliable allies. And our desire to see our national soil free of foreign occupation and America's need for military bases. These truths were impossible for most citizens to see at the time. This article was from 1965. In his notes on American intervention in the Third World, Ahmad states that at one point America symbolized possibility and promises because Americans had declared their commitment to the right of self-determination, had asserted as inalienable the people's right to revolution, and charged them with the duty to exercise that right. A belief in anti-imperialist America was part of the mythology he learned growing up in Pakistan. But this idealist picture of U.S. policies was eventually shattered, however, when he and others began to examine the realities of American foreign policy that stood in sharp contrast to the myths we had nourished. The actions of the U.S. government and major corporations that flagrantly betrayed principles embodied in the Declaration of Independence and were anti-nationalist, opposed to revolutions, supportive of dictatorships and fascists, and violently interventionist. People in Pakistan and elsewhere finally woke up when they realized that America was a status quo-seeking interventionist monolith, and it was the war in Vietnam that laid to rest the Third World's myths and illusions. Ahmad pays his respects to those American historians and economists, for example, William Appleman Williams, Paul Barron, Harry Magdoff, and Gabriel Kolko, who helped him and others find the roots of American foreign policy in monopoly capitalism and identify it as a policy in the service of corporations rather than of the public at large. U.S. imperialism, as these and other writers have argued, is in the very bloodstream of the capitalist system. It is inherent to its very nature, not some accidental byproduct. Ahmad claims that U.S. imperialism feeds on what Edward Burns has described as America's extraordinary conception of mission. It is a product, at least in part, of a deep and popularly held belief in the uniqueness of America and its perfection as a political model. He goes on to say, this is Ahmad, that since 1945, no president, Secretary of State, or Secretary of Defense has failed to reproduce and exploit this theme. I would argue that despite the naive belief of many liberals, no future president of this imperialist system will fail to reproduce it as well. In his discussion of the Cold War from the standpoint of its victims, which is a very powerful essay, Ahmad forces us to confront the actual toll of U.S. imperialism from the end of World War II to the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991. He points out that during the so-called Cold War, more than 20 million people died, countless millions were wounded, and more than 100 million people were rendered refugees by what have been variously described as limited and covert wars. Well, they weren't limited for people in the Third World. Virtually all the victims of these wars were people of color in the Third World, the expendable ones on the receiving end of a massive growth in the arms race, resulting in high-tech weapons, except the big one, being tested on human beings in real-life battlefields of Korea, Vietnam, Laos, Lebanon, Afghanistan, and Iraq. He states that some 12 million people died in wars fought in these countries. Drawing on the work of his friend and eminent scholar and activist Edward Said, Ahmad tells us the history of the past four centuries, he's here especially talking about the Third World, is a history of barely recognized Holocausts. For the peoples and nations under assault, those belittled wars were always systemic and often total wars that had profound historical consequences. They were devastating, though most U.S. citizens barely noticed the slaughter in post-World War II, except when the body bags came home from Korea and Vietnam. In his fine work, The New Imperialism, David Harvey analyzes the political economy of the U.S. empire. He first tells us, however, that we know a great deal about U.S. military imperialism abroad. Much is both known and documented from official or quasi-official sources, which is true. There's an absolute mountain of data. And what a despicable and deeply distressing record it is. Liquidation can come he argues, by a variety of means. The economic power to dominate can be used with equally destructive effect as physical force. Actually, the annual death toll in the Third World from imperialism is far greater than all the wars combined in any single year. You add up starvation, malnutrition, etc. Harvey gives us a brief history lesson in U.S. imperialism since the 1940s, stating that two cardinal principles of international strategic practices had been defined during World War II, and these remain set in stone thereafter. The social order in the U.S. should remain stable. That means no radical redistribution of wealth or power, and no challenge to the elite and or capitalist class control would be tolerated. And there should be a continuous expansion of capitalism to ensure domestic tranquility. The U.S. used its own military power, covert operations, and all manner of economic pressure to ensure the creation or continuation of friendly governments. To this end, it was prepared to support the overthrow of democratically elected governments and to engage directly or indirectly in liquidating those considered opposed to U.S. interests. The key to this imperialist process, according to Harvey, is one fundamental fact. In any conflict between democracy and order and stability built upon property interests, your U.S. ruling class always chooses the latter. It's 100-0. The movements that arose to challenge capitalist imperialism were frequently crushed with ferocious violence by state powers acting in the name of order and stability. Client states supported militarily or in some instances with forces trained by the U.S., as in El Salvador and Nicaragua, took the lead in repressions and liquidations to ruthlessly check activist movements challenging capitalism and imperialism. Militaristic imperialism was absolutely necessary in order to ensure that the benefits of the global system were highly concentrated among a restricted class of multinational CEOs and financiers. This class looked, as always, to the U.S. to protect its asset values and the rights of property and ownership. It paid little heed to place-bound or national loyalties or traditions. It could be multiracial, multiethnic, multicultural, and cosmopolitan. In his People's History of the United States, you all remember that from a year or two ago, Howard Zinn discusses the political economy of the U.S. coming out of World War II that helped shape post-war imperialism. The ruling elites needed a permanent war economy to keep the capitalist system going, as they greatly feared a repeat of the Great Depression of the 1930s. They realized that the state, the government, had to subsidize private capital in order to avoid another economic catastrophe. The term permanent war economy was uttered by Charles Wilson, the CEO of General Electric, who warned that after the war, the U.S. had to keep the war economy it had in World War II, with the economic system mainly run by corporate executives and geared to military production and profit. Noam Chomsky also argues that after World War II, most economists and business leaders expected a depression unless there could be massive government aid of the kind that during the war years finally overcame the Great Depression. Of course, business leaders understood that social spending could also avert a market collapse like the 1930s, but it has a downside. You know, it tends to have a democratizing and redistributive effect, whereas military spending is a gift to the corporate elite that keeps on giving. Business leaders were also aware that high-tech industry could not survive in a truly competitive free enterprise economy, and the government must be the savior for their companies. Therefore, virtually the entire new economy after World War II has relied heavily on the military cover to socialize risk. Okay? We'll pay for it, but to keep profit private, often after many decades. In essence, the permanent war economy has an economic and purely military function, and one cannot understand the true nature of imperialism apart from it. The context for Zinn's insights on World War II and the Cold War actually goes back to the Soviet Revolution of 1917 and efforts to destroy, the USSR, and any nation or movement that attempted to challenge capitalist hegemony in the world. Writer and former U.S. State Department official William Bloom argues that the root of the present imperialist struggle lies with the war that began with the Russian Revolution in 1917 and the Red Scare of the 1920s, continued through the McCarthyism of the 1950s to the Reagan Crusade against the evil empire of the 1980s. And now we're in an extension of this war with the war against terrorism. He argues that for more than 70 years until the fall of the USSR, people here were subjected to relentless anti-communist indoctrination, imbibed with their mother's milk and spelled out in their school books. Daily newspapers told them about it. Ministers found sermons in it. Politicians were elected with it. The emerging form of imperialism that took sort of a new shape in the 40s and beyond, according to Bloom, undermined the remarkable international goodwill and credibility enjoyed by the U.S. at the close of World War II that was dissipated country by country, intervention by intervention. The opportunity that was there after World War II to build the war-ravaged world anew, to lay the foundations for peace, prosperity, and justice, collapsed under the awful weight, he argues, of anti-communism. He asks us to ponder a profound dilemma. What did the victims of U.S. anti-communism in the Third World do to bring U.S. intervention, which has brought down upon them the wrath of the world's most powerful nation? He argues it has been self-determination. That's their crime. The desire, born of perceived need and principle, to pursue a path of development independent of U.S. foreign policy objections. Most commonly, this has been manifested in the ambition to free themselves from economic and political subservience to the U.S., their refusal to be a pawn in the Cold War, or the attempt to alter or replace a government which held to neither of these aspirations. This worldwide struggle of the victims of imperialism, the people Franz Fanon called the wretched of the earth, lies at the root of fanatical U.S. efforts to maintain its worldwide empire. In an article for the website ZNet entitled Imperialism 101, The U.S. Addiction to War, Mayhem, and Madness, Stephen Lendman asserts there is no longer a dispute that the U.S. pursues an imperial agenda. Expansion and militarism have always been in our DNA since the early settlers confronted the nation's original inhabitants and then over the next few hundred years slaughtered millions of them to seize their land and resources. Our Declaration of Independence referred to merciless Indian savages and thus gave colonial Americans a moral justification to remove them. Therefore, in our imperial wisdom, we came, we stole, and we conquered for their own good. Lendman jumps ahead in this imperialist lesson to Theodore Roosevelt, one of the nation's most belligerent and racist imperialists. During his era, Roosevelt's aggression extended the U.S. empire to the Philippines, Cuba, Haiti, Guam, the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, and the Canal Zone part of Colombia that, just on its own, broke away to become the new nation of Panama. This venture, of course, was cooked up by Roosevelt and other U.S. officials and was a blatantly illegal and imperialist action. Woodrow Wilson, who I would argue even beat Roosevelt as an imperialist and racist, managed to mystify citizens around the world with his call for the right to self-determination. This deep concern on his part included the military occupation of Nicaragua, Haiti, which lasted for 20 years, and the Dominican Republic, and the invasion of Mexico. This was all to help them have self-determination, evidently. In 1916, Wilson was reelected on a platform promise to keep the United States out of the war in Europe that began in 1914. He was elected on the platform. He kept us out of war. According to Lendman, Wilson had to promise that, as the U.S. public overwhelmingly wanted nothing to do with World War I at that point. But he no sooner was reelected than he began making plans to get us into it. Once in the war, he managed to control most public anti-war sentiment with the help of the Espionage and Sedition Acts that allowed no criticism of the government, the armed forces, or the war effort. Whether it was Roosevelt, Wilson, or later presidents, Lendman claims, at the heart of U.S. imperialism has always been the pursuit of wealth and power and a system of governance beholden to capital, now more than ever dominated by giant predatory corporations. Parenti would agree with Lendman's following assertion. It is more true that the flag goes where commerce directs it to secure new markets and a corporate-friendly environment once they've been opened for business. That's how imperialism works and why war is an effective geopolitical way to pursue it. War is just geopolitics by other means, and powerful capital-controlled countries like the U.S. use it freely because it works so well most often. Lendman claims there hasn't been much of a problem in the U.S. convincing citizens to support imperialist policies, so he takes issue with Parenti. As time and again, the public is willing to swallow most any reasons government officials tell them, of course reinforced by the corporate media trumpeting them like gospel, to get them to go along with the schemes they have in mind, no matter how outrageous they are. As with Parenti, therefore, Lendman actually believes U.S. imperialism has been quite successful. The scaremongering scam has been used so often with the same or similar language and that later proved false, you'd think the public by now would have caught on. But you'd be wrong. Up to now, it's worked like a charm every time, proving you can fool most of the people all the time. University of Texas scholar and activist Robert Jensen, whose insights we have examined in this course from his book Citizens of the Empire, also complements Parenti's critique of empire. Jensen believes that Americans need to come to terms with a harsh reality. In the post-World War II world, a primary function of the U.S. military has been to kill mostly non-white people in the Third World to extend and deepen American power. Therefore, he opposes both nationalism and patriotism, arguing it is time to sweep away the notion, patriotism, and acknowledge it as morally, politically, and intellectually bankrupt. His critique of the link between imperialism and patriotism, therefore, is one that forces, especially progressives, to re-examine their fundamental beliefs about the nation and its policies. He, too, asks a simple question that is almost never addressed by our nation's educational institutions and mass media. Why is it that our political culture, the highest expression of the ideals of freedom and democracy, has routinely gone around the world, overthrowing democratically elected governments, supporting brutal dictators, funding and training proxy terrorist armies, and unleashing brutal attacks on civilians when we go to war? Good question. I think Parenti's analysis in Against Empire provides a very cogent and truthful answer to Jensen's anguished question. And I'm sure it's a question any concerned person in this society has asked. Jensen claims that in the U.S., patriots not only can get by without knowing much about the wider world, but are systematically encouraged not to think independently or critically and institutionally, to accept a mythology of the United States as a benevolent, misunderstood, flawed giant as it lumbers around the world trying to do good. It is this fundamental proposition, I argue, it is this fundamental proposition that the U.S. government is a force for good in the world that must be analyzed objectively, honestly, confronted, and ripped out by the roots if we are to end the imperialist terror that this government has unleashed on people around the world. Let's take a break.
You're listening to Dr. John Marciano from his 2007 public class series on empire as a way of life. Since retiring from the State University of New York, Marciano moved to Santa Monica, California, where he now gives free public classes open to anyone on the subjects of American history and politics. Each year, the class is centered on a particular book, and students are also assigned articles and other material related to the topic. They meet once a month for a lecture on the reading by Marciano, followed by a discussion, which we'll hear next. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren.
Let's have our usual discussion. I don't know who's first, Jim, Kit?
We sold these books at the Midnight Special for a long time, and Parente's books, and I always wanted to read them, so I was glad that we got the opportunity to do this. And I thought it was really great, except at the beginning I was not very happy with it. And he pointed out that there's a possibility of capitalism without imperialism. And I don't see that. And from all the things I've ever read, it was a necessity of capitalism to grow. And that even in very minor, primitive capitalism, it was always whoever grew out to the next one down the line. And I was kind of surprised that he made that statement in there.
I'm actually going to jot some things down because I haven't been in touch with him for a while. I've known Michael for a number of years. And it'd be interesting to have him here because we agree on most things, but to have two Sicilian Americans arguing about these issues would be very interesting. But I want to ask him, because I was curious about that point too, and thinking of a number of books he's written since this came out, it seems to contradict the general argument. And so I'm going to send him an email that, you know, these are things that were raised in the group, and he'll get back to me, and I'll share it with you. So thank you for raising it.
I'm just puzzled about the kind of explanation that Parenti and lots of other people in the course are giving. Is it supposed to be that imperialism is one theme in American foreign policy, a strong theme, and so on and so forth, but there are other possible desires, thrusts for Americans? I mean, again, there's this question of, keeps coming up in my mind, the United Nations, or perhaps other aid programs. Are these always in the service of imperialism or not? I mean, are you going to picture American foreign policy as monolithic, as having only one goal, or does it have many, with the maybe imperialism as at least a very dominant one? I mean, I'm not sure what kind of explanation we're being asked to accept here.
Expand on that a little more. I mean, in terms of what he seems to be arguing?
Well, Parenti, but I'm just repeating myself when I raise the same point about William Appleman Williams. But Parenti, too, because he's covering the period when the United Nations was very much in force and promoted, and seemingly with American support. Think of the aid programs. I mean, you might say, well, these are all minor, and they're always in the service of imperialism and so on. But is that so clear? And in any case, why should the United States support an organization like the United Nations, which is, after all, has a Security Council, and the United States is only one among five countries that has a veto. So why should we promote that if we're going to be imperialist and the like?
This is something that Kit and I have talked about, and he's raised in the group, in terms of the role of the United Nations. It would seem to me that the Parenti, you know, again, try to think of how he would respond, and then I'll respond, that probably argued that some of the agencies of the United Nations have done some marvelous work since the founding of the organization we're talking now more than 60 years. But I think at the same time, he would argue that in terms of U.S. aggression, U.S. imperialism in the world, especially in the third world, not just in the third world, because some of the earliest U.S. moves in the world that involved the Central Intelligence Agency were not, quote-unquote, in the third world. They were against Italy and Greece and France after World War II. They were to disrupt in Italy and France, of course, the possibility that Communist Party would win power. So millions, tens of millions of dollars were pumped into Italy and France, and then hundreds of millions of dollars under the Truman Doctrine to defeat the left in Greece. I think he'd make the argument, and I would make the argument, that in terms of the fundamental thrust, even granting certainly the potential and some of the reality of the UN to temper aggression in the world, that as an institution, as an organization, it has been unable to really block the U.S. assault, imperialist assault, especially in the Third World, in Vietnam, against China, Laos, Cambodia, Nicaragua, El Salvador, I mean, just, you know, throw a dart, Southern Africa, Angola, Mozambique, etc. And in saying that, not necessarily being critical of the U.N., because the U.S., in a sense, was always trying to, in the U.S., the people making the decisions for the government. And here we've got to be clear, because it's not the U.S. as a whole. Chalmers Johnson's new book is especially powerful on describing how the executive branch of government, increasingly since Truman, but starting with Roosevelt, has bypassed Congress totally. So there's no discussion whatsoever, no public discussion whatsoever of involving the special forces or the CIA in this country or that country. So, and people in the UN, of course, didn't know this. So you can't, I mean, you can't really fault this institution when the U.S. is clearly a smaller group within the U.S., even bypassing the elected officials of the people, and, of course, never worrying about the judiciary, because the judiciary has never confronted the ability of the president since World War II on the issue of war. I mean, they absolutely refused to deal with these issues during Vietnam or any other war. So I think you're right, but at the same time, it has been unable to block this, what Iqbal Ahmad would call this violent, it wasn't a cold war, it was a hot war against the Third World. No institution within the U.S. or no world institution has been able to block that. The only thing that has blocked the U.S., of course, in Korea and Vietnam and elsewhere, has been the resistance of the people who were victimized by the U.S., aided during the Vietnam War by a very strong anti-war movement, and aided by, even though there wasn't that kind of anti-war movement during the Korean War, after the initial, certain initial successes by the U.S. when they marched under MacArthur to the Yalu River, public opinion turns dramatically against the Korean War. A lot of Korean War was an extremely unpopular war in the U.S. by polling data. There weren't massive demonstrations in the U.S. as in 1952, as we found in, you know, 1968. So it's a mixed bag.
Yeah, hi, I'm Jay from Santa Monica. I think your last point was a segue into the points I would make, because reading about Parenti's analysis, which is fine as far as it goes, basically is what I consider a looking back analysis, what it has been, what we have undergone, and has not particularly addressed the future, or what I'll call a macro analysis of empires in general, because it's been specific basically to the United States. My thinking going through this is that all empires have a natural evolutionary dynamic. Basically, they grow until they're too large to control their borders or to defend themselves. The Roman, the Ottoman, the Catholic, the Islamic, the Chinese, the Aztec, and the Soviet empires all have that in common. And I think it is a natural dynamic of which the same will happen to the United States, which is happening now. Secondly, there's massive new forces happening now that didn't happen 50 years ago. Tom Friedman's work on globalization, not that I agree with it, but he does point out dramatically how this function of the virtual economies that business operates on has eliminated the need for control of physical geography and control of the physical government, such as in Vietnam, where they're making Van Heusen shirts, China, oh, I don't have to say how much we're importing from them, that these new forces, primarily driven by communication, have a fundamental aspect on the prior analysis and methodologies we used on American search for markets and control for markets. And lastly, within the United States, I don't think he deals with this question except explaining it without talking about what the resolution is. The function that we have a democratic election says of in the country as really as a function of domestic policy, and rarely has foreign policy been the key component in elections, putting the Kennedy-Nixon missile gap aside for the moment, which is a good example where it was. But basically, we have a dictatorship in foreign policy in this country, which calls for a new structure, a new process to control the foreign policy power of the president. Until we have that, we're going to just keep on going until the natural evolution of the empire just collapses on its borders.
Jay, would you talk a little more about, because this is a really powerful point. So we have a formal democratic structure even granting how much money is involved, but let's say a formal democratic structure politically in terms of elections, in contradiction with a dictatorship in foreign policy.
Precisely, no. Domestic policy drives the so-called democratic election process in the country. There's gay marriage, abortion, medical coverage. Think of all the issues in the last previous presidential elections. Going back to Nixon Kennedy, which was the exception. Nixon Kennedy was the missile gap, or the Soviet this, the Soviet that. But even prior to that, under Eisenhower, was get out of the war. Part of it was to get out of the Korean War, but primarily all the president, Roosevelt was, of course, the economy. All his elections were basically built on the economy. So I see where foreign policy is not the determinant in the democratic process of elections, and thus foreign policy winds up really being a dictatorship in the way it's handled within the United States.
And again, for the some of you will end up reading Chalmers Johnson's newest book, Nemesis, but he also discussed this in Sorrows of Empire. His argument that increasingly that dictatorship, that power to involve the U.S. in wars, covert, overt, is undermining the democratic institutions of society so that there's no public debate. Should we go to war? We'll have a full debate.
And there's two key important points. First of all, today in the year 2007, we are dramatically different in the way that the secret government has been operating. Up to now through the CIA and all these years, it's been the government has a secret agenda, a secret organization in effect through the Central Intelligence Agency, but it's been a government operated. Today we have almost 150,000 private contractors in Baghdad that is now pulling in industry, that Blackwater, this massive expansion of Blackwater by the privatization of the secret foreign policy is now taking on an enormous new step, and it's going to basically double the effort, but it's going to be doubling it by channeling, on the one hand, through private entities as well as the public government military entities. There'll be private armies.
Just a final thought bouncing off of what Jay's raised, that I think Parenti, Grandin, Roxanne, Dunbar-Ortiz, John Bellamy Foster, any of the readings, I would argue Williams would make this argument too, that whether it's the secret government, whether it's the CIA, whether it's overt involvement by the U.S. government, whether it's private armies, that the form of imperialism can change, but that the basic goals remain the same. So if it's a set of private contractors in Iraq doing what, let's say, the CIA might be doing, their argument would be that the real goals don't change. The form of how it's done. But that is a new phenomenon. And incredibly, it's not that there weren't any private contractors in Vietnam during the war, but this has expanded dramatically so that within, for example, the armed forces, people in the armed forces are not doing KP, are not feeding people, are not driving trucks. This has all been subcontracted out. So if you're looking for a job,
These 70 pages were some of the best 70 pages I've read in a while. I really thought he really nailed so much. And I thought your discussion of it was excellent. And you had me until the last bit. And I may have misinterpreted something that you said at the end. I don't know. But this seems to be a bone of contention before. And that I really like what he said about how war hysteria is engendered from the top down, not from the bottom up, that the masses are swept along in that. And I agree with you that we're not kept well informed of what's going on internationally. But if you implied in the end of what you had to say that people don't know what's going on or don't know what's happening, or I disagree so much with that as I have before, if maybe not exactly what's going on in a particular country. I think people recognize, at least where I grew up, what the government of the United States is about. I don't think they have a lot of illusions. I think a lot of people don't vote because of that. I think a lot of people don't see the American state as being for them or about them. And I just think we're in the master's house. I don't like to use this illusion, but it's a little bit, the master in the field, slave. I don't like to use that, but we're in the master's house, and occasionally we'll spit in the soup, but it hasn't been shown to the American people, or it has been shown to the American people, what happens exactly if you oppose. There hasn't been a real example of a successful defeat of the system, and it has been shown over and over what happens if you try to go against it. So I just think it's one of those, if you can't beat them, join them.